This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to L&G Talks Asset Management. My name is Harry Brooks. I'm Head of Client Editorial, and today I'm joined by Ben Bennett, our Chief Investment Strategist, Asia, to discuss the big ideas that are shaping markets today. Ben, I checked when we last caught up and it was way back in February. What's been going on in your world and have you been enjoying the summer of sport from Hong Kong?
It's been far too long, isn't it? We missed already the Hong Kong Sevens, which was back in April. That seems a long time ago. Now, of course, we're focusing on the World Cup. Here in Hong Kong, though, a lot of the games are on at like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. So it's been a bit tricky to keep up. But in other news, my wife is pregnant and due to give birth next week. So maybe I'll be up in time for the final to watch England's glory. That could be pretty late by the time that this is published, of course.
Congratulations, Ben. That's excellent news.
Thank you.
So a week after we last caught up back in February, that the conflict in the Middle East kicked off, and it's been one of the biggest topics, of course, in markets ever since. We're recording this on the Wednesday morning, and the interim peace agreement that's been in place for the last couple of weeks looks to be faltering now, with US striking military targets in Iran in response to attacks on ships in the Straits of Hormuz. What I'd like to ask you about, though, really is the relationship between what's been going on in the Middle East and US government bond yields, as that's an absolutely critical number for investors. Throughout the spring, yields rose steadily as the energy shock fed through to inflation expectations. And when that interim peace agreement was signed, investors quickly took oil risk off the table, with oil futures dropping about a fifth, something like that, over June last month. My question is, why didn't we see Treasury yields respond to that big drop in oil? Wouldn't you have expected the oil move to have an impact? And how does this latest re-escalation affect the outlook?
That's right. I think as an investor, we were definitely very interested in the impact on bond yields, because that drives a lot of pricing, certainly for bonds, of course, directly. But then, equities, yield sensitive equities and how they perform versus growth equities, all that sort of stuff. So really important what bond yields do. And as you say, at the beginning of the conflict, the movement in oil prices directly fed through to yields. So, oil price, Brent, doubled from $60 at the start of the year all the way to $120 a barrel at the peak. And that coincided with the 10-year US yield that started the year, near 4%. Peaking up at sort of 4.7%. So, that increased as oil prices increased. Perception, of course, being that, higher inflation, potentially rate hikes would be needed to get that inflation under control. But as you rightly say as well, the de-escalation in the Middle East, notwithstanding what's happening overnight, but the gradual de-escalation and the easing of conditions in the Strait of Hormuz has led to the price of oil falling back down close to where it was the start of the year, a little bit higher still. But 10-year yields, having peaked at 4.7% as of yesterday's close on the Tuesday, the 7th of July, was still up at 4.6%. So pretty much at the peak of 4.7%, very close to those peaks. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One is that it's that increase in oil price that we saw is going to take time to feed through the system. I mean, people put in orders for various oil related things at higher prices that are still having to then be passed on to consumers. I mean, hopefully that's not a massive impact, but that is going to take a while. But also, the US economic growth has been better than expected. Generally, earnings have been very strong. The job market has been relatively robust. So the US economy didn't really do poorly, even when oil prices were high. So, we're starting at a relatively robust growth, I guess, in the US. And that suggests that maybe the Federal Reserve will still have to potentially tighten policy by the end of the year. I mean, that's still up in the air. That is a question. And if they do have to tighten policy by the end of the year, then that justifies why yields are still relatively high. So that's the reason why, and that's the reason why I guess bond yields have dislocated somewhat from the energy price, and why they could still stay high, I guess, for a few more months.
Complex mix of factors going on in the US. Outside the US, one of the knock-on effects of that rise in yield in sort of March to May-ish was weakness in Asian currencies. Japanese yen, I'm thinking of in particular, became really quite weak, stayed quite weak against the dollar. How much of that yen weakness would you attribute to the interest rate differential, meaning investors might prefer to park their cash in higher yielding dollar assets rather than the yen? And how much was it about Japanese fiscal policy?
Yeah, it's a bit like the chicken and the egg sort of question. What comes first, isn't it? I think the best answer is that you sort of need both at the same time. You need to have the pressure. You need to have higher US yields and the associated strength of dollar, of course, because if US yields are higher, you generally see a stronger dollar because people are attracted to those higher US yields. That strength in the dollar puts pressure on other currencies globally, and it puts particular pressure on currencies that are seen as weaker from a fiscal perspective or from a trade perspective, perhaps. So during the last few months, we have seen emerging market currencies in Asia that have been big importers of oil in the past that were seen as particularly vulnerable to the supply constraints. So we're talking about Indonesia, India, Philippines. Those currencies got under pressure, so weakening currencies. And then there's a bit of a spiral because the central banks in those countries see their currency weakening. They know that that means that they're going to have to import inflation because everything's going to be costing them more, not just oil, but everything if the currency's falling. And they need to hike interest rates to get that imported inflation under control. And by hiking interest rates, that puts a bit of a growth headwind in place as well. So you can see that spiraling. And then you mentioned Japan. Japan is, of course, not an emerging market, it's a developed market, but it also imports a lot of oil. And it has this fiscal question mark from the new prime minister talking about big investments, talking about increasing the fiscal spending. That would lead to, you know, needing to raise more debt, more issuance, more Japanese government bond issuance. Again, that's been putting pressure on the yen. The yen versus the dollar, at least, is at a sort of 40-year weak point in sort of notional terms, yen versus the dollar at 162. And we have seen recently probable intervention by Japanese authorities, and they might have to continue to do that. But, you know, intervention doesn't solve the underlying issues, which is there's a big interest rate differential. The, you know, US bond yields are higher than Japanese bond yields, which is sucking money out. And also that fiscal question. So, you know, the problem is the intervention can slow the move, but it's not going to pause it until, yeah, we see a big valuation change or we see a big policy change. I can imagine this continuing for a little bit longer.
So another fiscal question mark is in Europe with France's challenging debt dynamics, adding a lot of complexity to speculation around the presidential election that's coming up in April. What's going on in France? How big is that debt issue? And what are markets telling us about the possible paths forwards?
There's a bit of the same story as what I was mentioning before. You know, when the US is tightening policy, it drains money from the system and it causes potential issues to come into under the microscope. And, you know, France, not just France, to be fair, there's lots of countries with debt dynamics that don't look sustainable. You know, if you look at where bond yields are, the funding costs, and you look at the size of the deficits, the size of the amount of debt that these countries have. Japan, I mentioned before, and France is another one where it looks as though something has got to give, right? And again, you try and have a look as an investor about what could be the event in the horizon that causes more people to focus on this and potentially worry about it and lead to more risk premium going into markets. Here we'd be talking, of course, about the French government bond yield increasing versus, say, the German bond yield, which is seen as the risk-free in the euro land, isn't it? So the French bond yield at 10-year point, it trades about 0.8% higher than the German bond yield. So you get a premium already, but the question is, could that go higher next year? It seems crazy to talk about next year, but we are in the second half of 2026 already, aren't we? But next year in April, there's a presidential election in France. That could be a potential trigger for people to talk about French sustainable debt, to talk about what policy might be, fiscal policy. So it's one area that we're looking at from portfolio perspective. You know, what is our risk to French government debt? Do we want to underweight that? Do we want to have a look at that spread potentially widening? Again, it's, I'm not talking about the next couple of weeks, am I? But, you know, in the next few months, I bet this is what people, a lot of people will be talking about as we get towards the end of the year when they start writing their 2027 outlooks, for example.
No doubt. Well, I felt we could talk about politics and geopolitics for hours, but moving away a bit from those themes, AI, of course, has remained hugely important force propelling markets for this year today and before then. For most of this year, there seemed to be this consistent trend of high volatility in AI-related assets accompanied by big price gains. But just over the last month, something did seem to change, at least momentarily. The volatility we still saw, but the gains were absent. Has something changed in the way that investors are seeing the AI story playing out? And who might ultimately benefit if this new narrative turns out to be correct?
This isn't the first time that we've seen a pause in the AI trend, or perhaps a pause, a slight shift away from what is in investors, what's the investors' focus. Last year, we also saw some of those big hyperscaler equity share prices level off before ramping up again earlier this year, thanks to some extraordinary earnings. I mean, Q1 earnings in the US, the S&P 500 was the earnings were up in the first quarter nearly 30% compared to the previous year's first quarter, and the tech sector up nearly 60%, so 55-60%. And that's, you know, when we talk about potential bubbles or potential similarities to the dot-com bubble that we saw in the early 2000s, the big difference is that we are seeing amazing earnings. And that's one of the reasons why we think, again, this is more likely to be a pause or a shift in the tech trade, in the AI trade, rather than a popping of any bubble. So because the earnings are still there, and we're about to start the Q2 earnings season, and expectations for that is again for a sort of 20-something, low 20% increase compared to the second quarter of last year, and technology to do really well, of course, within that. So the big question for me, and when we would start to talk about topping out and maybe the technology, the AI trade coming to an end, would be the sustainability of those earnings. I mean, the earnings are brilliant right now, but those earnings can't carry on going up by 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever percent every year, because yeah, at some point they'll take over the world, of course. But yeah, so it's how sustainable that is, when it levels off, when do investors question potentially that they've got overly optimistic about some of those earnings. I don't think it's yet, but you know, that's the thing I've got in mind.
Just incredible, those earnings figures, really. AI has also been too big to ignore in credit markets, of course, with the hyperscalers you mentioned a second ago, tapping sources of funding, initially, I think, in the US, but increasingly now in Europe as well. How is the massive AI infrastructure build-out affecting credit markets more broadly? And how is the story here different from what we're seeing in equity markets?
Yeah, I mentioned the sustainability of earnings being a question about, you know, whether or not the AI trade can continue. The other place that I'm looking at is the funding of the, as you say, the infrastructure build out, which is huge. And it's one reason why earnings are fabulous, because companies that produce the things for this AI build out are making loads and loads and loads of money, like the memory chip makers, for example, making tons of money because there's a massive demand for their product. Now, if the companies buying these products struggle to finance these purchases, then again, you'd question those earnings, wouldn't you? A lot of this is being funded in debt markets. It's being funded in private markets, public markets. It's being funded in with banks as well. I mean, if I'm looking at public corporate bond markets, issuance in the US dollar investment grade market, for example, is about running 25% higher than the average of the last 5 years or so. So it's a decent chunk more debt. And it's from a sector that has historically had quite little debt, the technology sector, but it's now starting to become a much more important sector. And we do see this. And I go back, actually, not necessarily to the dot-com bubble back in the early 2000s, but the European telecom sector back in the early 2000s. They were buying all the 3G licenses. They were doing huge amounts of debt. at that time to fund those 3G licenses. And it was when indigestion in the credit market started to really hurt those bonds that we started to see the equity market wobble as well. Equity investors were worried about the funding. That would be, for me, a warning sign for the equity markets if we were to see some similar indigestion in credit markets. So far, we've seen very little indigestion. Credit markets, the credit spreads are still close to the all-time tight. So we're not seeing it. We're seeing one or two deals that are maybe struggling to be digested. But I mean, there's a lot of money that's being raised, so that's understandable. But broadly, we haven't seen the indigestion yet. But again, that would be something I'd be looking out for.
We'll be keeping an eye on those spreads. Sticking with the theme of possible opportunities, I'm sure there will be investors who will see this pause for breath in AI stocks as an opportunity to get in at slightly lower prices. Another possible opportunity might see in Chinese equities, which have lagged, I think, other big markets so far this year. How do you see that? Why have they underperformed some other markets? And is there a potential opportunity here?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, yeah, just to put some numbers on the Chinese stock market. So the Hang Seng here in Hong Kong down this year 8%. So that's really lagged, isn't it, compared to global equities that are generally up decent amounts. The CSI 300, which is the onshore Chinese equity market, that's still up, but only 3.5%. There's a lot of similarities potentially between what we see in China today and what we saw in South Korea 18 months, 2 years ago, just before that market went almost vertically upwards. It's been lagging in China, the markets, of course. There's a lot of value there. The P/E ratios are very low. So, the price is low versus the earnings. And there's also been a technology sector that is underperformed. There's a few companies in China where you look at the big companies' share price in China, technology companies really underperformed. Again, quite similar to what we saw in Korea with companies like Samsung, for example, really underperforming before, again, their share price took off. So the question is, are we looking at another opportunity where, everyone will suddenly realize, wow, China could be an amazing tech story. Look how cheap it is. And perhaps the share price, the stock market doubles like we've seen in Korea, more than doubles. I would be skeptical just because I don't see what the catalyst is necessarily. In Korea, it was about chips, just suddenly the things that SK Hynix and Samsung made suddenly becoming incredibly popular. China is a much bigger economy. There's much more things going on there. Chinese domestic consumer is still quite weak because of the impact of the housing market collapse that we saw several years ago now, but it's still impacting it. And the last point, I suppose, is that, Chinese companies generally have got other priorities, not necessarily just profitability, which is something that, as a Western investor, we get used to companies just trying to maximize profits, not necessarily the number one priority for Chinese companies. They have more social focus or more employment focus. So I would be surprised if we were to see Chinese equities take off. But from a valuation perspective, it's not a bad place to look at to try and find some cheap companies there. I'm sure there's some hidden gems for those for those investors willing to do their work.
No doubt. Well, look, I feel like we covered absolutely loads, but as always, there's bound to be some gems still waiting to be unearthed that I've not touched on at all. So what's your number of the week for us, Ben?
Yeah, so my number is -5%, and that's talking about things that have lagged. That's the performance so far this year of gold, which had been everyone's hot topic, hadn't it, earlier this year and towards the end of last year. Again, a little bit like South Korean equity markets had just gone to the moon, it seemed, in terms of the price. And yet now it's struggling a little bit. So the question is the gold run over? A little bit like US equities, I wouldn't be I'd say structurally, I'm still quite like gold, still quite like US technology equities. I think there's a little bit of a consolidation moment and, you know, gold facing the headwind, like a lot of other things, of higher rates. Gold doesn't have a yield. Of course, it just sits there doing nothing. So if you can get, if yields elsewhere start going up, then the relative value of gold generally should be lower, shouldn't it? Because you'd be wanting to buy the things with high yields a little bit more. But sort of longer term, it is still an amazing opportunity for central banks who want to diversify away from US holdings. And we see that across the globe. China, for example, just announced that their central bank has increased their holdings of gold again in June for another month, for 20 months in a row.
Your to the moon phrase earlier on made me think of the other big loser so far this year is crypto assets. I think Bitcoin is down by something like a third year to date. I've read a few different explanations, some of them more convincing than others, but the big one seems to be that investors' kind of speculative excitement around these assets has basically just all moved over to AI exposed stocks. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, not a lot makes sense to me sometimes when we talk about crypto. It's pretty tricky to like work out what's going on here. Look, there's similarities with gold. Of course there is. The big difference is what I mentioned before, the demand for central banks for an asset that's been around for thousands of years. You don't get that with crypto. The problem is that you still get some of those other headwinds, like higher yields elsewhere versus an asset that doesn't have an intrinsic yield. So I guess that's one of the reasons. But yeah, similar to what you've been thinking about, maybe some of the more speculative technology opportunities have maybe taken away some of the more speculative money that's been going into crypto. But yeah, like I said, I'm far from an expert in this topic.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for talking to me today. It's been really fascinating, and I feel like I've learned absolutely loads about all sorts of different things. And to our listeners at home, I hope you can join us for the next episode of L&G Talks Asset Management.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture a global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.